Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Here, the results are always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Here we will discuss the secrets of the universe. When we are done, you will never look at the stars or yourself the same again. Whether you are in a truck headed for the coast, or in a car coming home from the beach, or listening in your bed as you fall asleep, you are about to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you are going than you ever thought possible. In here, your potential is absolutely unlimited. Tonight, September 21st, 2005, is the debut of X-Squared Radio. We are dedicated to sharing the mysteries of the universe with you in a way that will fascinate you, inspire you, and even expand you. From the most current physics in the world to the most soul-drenching paranormal topics and everything in between, we promise you will grow in here. I believe everything we do will eventually affect the universe. I try to do it on purpose, every waking moment. I want to thank you for tuning in. For the next hour, you are in X-Squared Radio. If you would like to participate in tonight's program, you can reach me instantly by going to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Click on the X-Squared Radio link and access the show through the Harmony Live chat room provided by BBS Radio. This is faster than email, and no one is ever put on hold. I will follow your comments live on the radio and respond as I am inspired. If you ever wanted your voice and your thoughts to be addressed on global radio, this is your chance. As we expand the program over the next few months, we will add toll-free phone access so your thoughts in your voice can be heard throughout the universe. This is the most important subject material in the universe, so you might as well participate. Remember who you are, and let's get ready to enter X-Squared Radio. The Arc of Millions of Years is the greatest story on the universe. Volume 1 changes the foundations of religion and science as it solves the mystery of evolution and creation once and for all. It's about 530 pages, double-spaced for easy reading. You'll learn about the origin and destiny of the Earth. You'll learn about the ancient giants. You'll learn about man's long history of interaction with off-worlders. When you are done with that book, you will never look at the stars, your scriptures, or yourself the same again. Available at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com or your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstores. If you are tuned in tonight, then consider yourself one of those who are awake. You might have seen the movie at some time, rented it at home, or seen it in the theater, Joe versus the Volcano with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. Interesting movie. You should rent it. But Meg Ryan, who's the daughter of a very wealthy and eccentric man who employs Tom Hanks to please some volcano gods, she quotes her father by saying, "The vast majority of people go through life asleep, but there are a few of us that are awake and live in a constant state of amazement." So what is that like? Well, next time you're on the freeway in slow traffic, look around. You'll see hundreds of people, one by one, two by two. They're asleep. They have blank stares on their faces. They have turned off a part of their life so they don't have to experience it. They are unaware of hundreds of moments passing them by. I was at a lecture one time where Og Mandino was speaking. Wrote a series of books, starting with The World's Greatest Salesman. Interesting speaker. Said he interviewed a woman who was 114 years old. Wanted to know to what she attributed her long life and what things she would like to do if she had her life to live over again. The one comment that she made is that she would probably learn to dance. She never learned to dance in her 114 years. And she'd also said that her life had its moments, but if she had it to do over again, that's all she would have, is moments, one after the other. Now, if you're on that freeway and you see these people that are asleep in their cars, if you're driving faster than they are, and I'm not talking about tremendously faster, just so that you're never passed by anyone, you might move in and around them like pylons in a road course. You might be one of those drivers that's rarely passed. Now, I'm not saying that you are flashing past people and blowing off their doors. I'm saying that in an hour, you might travel an extra 5 or 10 miles in the same amount of time. This is sort of what it's like to be awake in a sea of people asleep in the universe. Well, this program, X Squared Radio, is going to help wake you up. You will be able to see things you didn't see before. And that observation effect is going to change your life. And it's going to change people around you. And it's going to change things around you. Instead of punctuating your life with paychecks or Sunday school services or other events, we're going to open the universe of moments to you. Anyone who is awake can manage a moment. Before you know it, you'll be stacking up moments one after another until you've made up a whole day of them. Believe me, a day like that will make you feel young and full and pleased with life. Now, we'll start small. We'll manage this program tonight, and then you can take what you learn here and grow until next week at this same time. So let's just take a second to pay some bills. The Ark of Millions of Years offers new light and discovery on the creation of the Earth. It is the Intelligent Design Handbook. Forward Magazine calls it the most comprehensive book ever written on the creation of the Earth. There is more solid evidence and scholarly meat between its covers than any book in print to date. But its writing style is easy and beautiful. Available at arcofmillionsofyears.com or your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth Bookstore. Now, we like to divide our radio program into sections. Each week, we will spend a little bit of time in each one of these sections. Of course, you can chat live by going to bbsradio.com, and you can access the Harmony live chat room. I will be reading these as the show goes on. And we'll be able to take the details from that, feed it right into the program, and that way you can get your thoughts out to the universe. The first section that we use in our program is called cosmology. Now, a lot of you might not know what cosmology is about, and that's understandable. It is not the study of makeup. It is the study of the universe, not just staring at stars, but understanding how things are formed, how things work in the universe. So tonight we're going to introduce the cosmology section of our program. and it starts with a little bit of current events. Yesterday, NASA announced we, the United States of America, and maybe some joint partners, are going to the moon in 2018. The staff spokesman said, think of it as Apollo on steroids. Now, I don't know how old my audience is, but some of you may have been alive when Apollo landed on the moon for the first time. I remember where I was, and some of you may remember where you were. Some of you may not have been born yet, but I can tell you, it was a pretty exciting time. The moon is a most interesting body in space, indeed. I'd like to share with you some unique things about our moon. Some of these things you may have heard in science fiction stories. Some of you may have seen on a Discovery Channel or heard on some paranormal talk radio program. But what you're going to hear tonight are the facts behind the science fiction. There is a theory that the moon is actually a chunk of the Earth that was split off during a planetary collision billions of years ago. Now, there's some flaws in this theory because of some of the excellent theories we have now. One of the things that we've been able to do, in which I have a little bit of expertise in history, is doing spectrographic analysis of the Earth. I haven't done spectrographic analysis of heavenly bodies, not enough time in one lifetime, but there are plenty of scientists that have done that. And what they have determined is that the composition of the Earth is primarily iron and nickel. Now, we have a lot of minerals on the Earth, but those are primarily the minerals that make up the Earth. However, the moon, our moon, is made up mostly of titanium and aluminum. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, although in this case you do have one, that if you're going to split off a body by slamming it with a hammer, chances are you're going to get a very representative chunk of that body. So it doesn't make much sense that you would have slammed something into the Earth and split off only titanium and aluminum. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? In fact, that's exactly the fact. The moon is entirely different composition than the Earth. And this week we've been observing the harvest moon. This is an annual moon that appears in the east, very near sunset. The sun is just over the horizon, and the moon is just above the horizon, and it is full. The sun's rays pass along the maximum arc of the circumference of the Earth, passing through all of the air in our atmosphere along that arc, and it creates quite a colorful moon. Even though the moon is some 275,000 miles away and appears like a bright headlight sometimes in the middle of the night, when it's a harvest moon, it appears about 4 to 6 times its normal size, and it's orange or red. The reason it's called a harvest moon is, well, long before the Edison effect, when we could illuminate our night and play clear until the sun comes up the next morning, the harvest moon provided light to farmers so that they could use its light to harvest their crops a little bit later into the evening. And it's kind of nice to look at the moon. Well, one of the things we notice about the moon is that the same side faces us all the time. We talk about the man in the moon. It doesn't take too much money these days to get a 20 or 30 power magnification, binoculars or telescope, and look at the moon. It's pretty darn bright when it's full, and you can see the Sea of Copernicus. You can see all of the craters that are on the surface of the moon that faces us. And one of the things that you notice is that although it's pretty bright, it's covered with kind of a dark gray layer. Now, here's the facts behind it. Cosmologists, those of us that are either aficionados of astronomy or know astronomical terms, talk about a term called albedo, A-L-B-E-D-O. This is the amount of light that a body reflects from the sun. The side of the moon that faces us is covered with a layer of iron dust, which of course has not oxidized into red because there's no oxygen in the atmosphere, if there was an atmosphere on the moon. And so it's nice and black laying on the surface of the moon. In fact, it blocks quite a bit of the reflected light from the sun. The albedo of the side of the moon that faces us is about 10%. Still bright enough to negotiate a sidewalk in the middle of the night with no street lights on a full moon. But what does the other side of the moon look like? Well, there are many pictures available of the far side of the moon, also called the dark side of the moon. You can pull them up on Google under images for yourself, and you can see it. It has craters, too, but they're very small, although numerous. There's also little or no iron dust. That makes the albedo of the far side of the moon just over 60%. What this means is that if the far side of the moon faced us during a full moon, we would probably have to wear sunglasses at night. One might even be able to grow crops 24 hours a day if that much light filled the night. Pretty amazing fact. Add to that the fact that the far side of the moon's crust is quite a bit thicker than the side that faces us. We have been around the moon many times with many satellites, and we've taken a lot of thermal imagery of the moon. We're very convinced that the far side of the moon has a thicker crust than the side that faces us. We'll talk a little bit more about that in subsequent shows, about what that means, why the moon has a tendency to revolve on its axis exactly, precisely at the right speed, so that the same side faces the Earth all the time, which means the revolution of the moon on its axis matches the orbit of the moon around the Earth. It is the only moon that we have ever seen with any telescope that does this. Pretty remarkable design. That concludes section one on cosmology. We'll cover that in a lot more detail in subsequent shows. We'll take a little bit of break here to pay some bills. The arc of millions of years offers new light and discovery on the creation of the Earth. It is the intelligent design handbook. No matter what church you attend, no matter what your ancestry or your present nationality, you have a history and a lineage which you might not be aware of. You are children of the stars. The real ET is in the mirror. If you want to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, where you might be going from here, you need to read The Arc of Millions of Years this year. The Arc of Millions of Years is the greatest story on the universe. It's available at your local Barnes & Noble, or Joseph Beth bookstores, or you can order it by going to www.arcofmillionsofyears.com. Even if you bought the book before the audiobook was available, if you request it by registering at the website, we will send it to you for free, by mail, on CD, ready to play in your car or truck, in case you don't have the time to read. Section two of our weekly radio program, we're going to cover a rather controversial subject. One we scientists try to avoid like the plague. It is one of those subjects that a lot of people talk about. There are a lot written about it, a lot of TV shows on it, a lot of radio shows on it. But tonight we're going to introduce a section we call UFOs. I know you've heard all the tired talk about whether they exist or whether they don't exist, and I'll listen to whatever story you have. I'll try to answer all your questions live on the radio each week. So, have I seen one? No. I've always wanted to. I've camped in remote mountains and deserts and even on the open ocean. I've seen many satellites, but I've never seen a UFO. Does that mean they don't exist? Well, my question as a scientist is, how can hundreds of thousands of people be wrong? But my other question is, where is the proof that they exist? That's one of the main quests of this section. Where is the proof? I would like to hear your stories. I would like to hear your testimonies. What bright lights you saw. What shape you saw. Where did you see it? When did you see it? Was it 20 years ago? Was it last weekend? These are the kinds of things we want to discover on this radio program. I want you to know that I don't refer to visitors to Earth as aliens. I may use the term extraterrestrials, but my preferred term, and the one we use throughout our book, is off-worlder. This simply means that they're not from our Earth at this time. It is a subject of great consternation among our people. I personally have wished that they would just get it over with and land on the White House lawn where CNN could put them on film and they could say those famous words, "Take me to your leader." No professional scientist will openly agree that these off-worlders exist, which is kind of strange for us because we're a rather open-minded lot. However, our lineage and our history and our culture and our mores and our traditions teach us that we're probably the only intelligent life in this neighborhood. And that even if we were interesting enough for some off-worlder to make the trip to get here, it would take them so long that it wouldn't be feasible. Well, that's also a subject of this section. Even though it's professional suicide, if you ever mention UFOs or aliens with your colleagues or students, we will talk about them on X Squared Radio because I and you want to know the truth. And we will find it with your help, if that is possible. Now, some of the things that open up when we think about off-worlders from a logical point of view is, what's the origin of UFOs? It appears they have been around for many thousands of years. Well, that means UFOs could have originated on Earth from a past advanced civilization, and they've been hanging around nearby or just out of sight or even on this planet for centuries, just out of our reach, some hitherto unexplored area of the Earth, maybe deep in the ocean or high in the Himalayas, some secret cave or some secret opening. They could also originate from some future generation of mankind and have figured out how to travel back in time to our day to keep us from screwing up, I don't know. Of course, the last option is that they originate on some distant planet and they traveled to us. Well, this is where it kind of gets interesting for we physicists, because we think of vast distances of the universe, not in terms of miles, as I mentioned before, but in terms of time. We look at things in light years. We look at things as how long does it take to travel at the speed of light to get to Earth, even though that direction may not be a straight line. And even if it were possible to fly a craft at the speed of light, of course, any physicist will tell you nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, the nearest star system to us that's the least bit interesting is at least 40 light years away from us. And if we assign any kind of scientific prowess to that civilization, we might say that they would be able to travel, well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say they can travel half the speed of light, about 90,000 miles per second. That's pretty fast. Even at that speed, however, they would just now be receiving our very first radio broadcasts that had any kind of strength to them at all. And they would, if they had gotten the message of the very first entertainment broadcasts on this planet, immediately jumped into their titanium can, fired up their engines, selected their best crew, and took off, they would not arrive here for another 35 years. It appears as though we have had visitors to this planet much, much longer than that. And so if this last option is, in fact, the truth, that UFOs originate on some distant planet in a distant star system, and they travel to us, then they must have a way to divide that cosmos. They must have a way to slip into some shortcut, some wormhole, some way of moving from where they are to where we are without having to travel in a straight line over open space, exposed to all kinds of lethal radiation, maybe having one generation after another of children while they steadfastly, faithfully stay on their course toward the little blue marble that they can barely see with their telescopes. Well, that's where the confusion comes in. That's where we physicists say, gee, we just don't understand that enough. Mathematically, however, we have talked about it quite a bit. Einstein and Mr. Rosen talked about a possibility called an Einstein-Rosen bridge. And that's what we're going to talk about. The Einstein-Rosen bridge is a wormhole, shall we call it, a time warp that's formed with the gravitational pull of a black hole involved. Well, how does a black hole work? Well, it's quite interesting. We have to talk about the life cycle of a star. And what we would like to talk about maybe is not how a star is born, because that's certainly an interesting subject. But when we're talking about wormholes and we're talking about traveling across vast distances of the galaxy, we're talking about very, very intense gravity in a very, very small space. There is no other mathematical or theoretical body in the universe other than a black hole that could cause this to happen. So let's just discuss just for a moment what a black hole might be. Well, first of all, mathematically, we know that black holes are formed from dead stars. Now, it takes a star at least 1.4 times the size of our sun. We call that a solar mass. So 1.4 solar masses or more. And now, mathematically, what happens is as the hydrogen fuel on the surface of a star begins to burn out, that is to say, all the hydrogen protons meet other hydrogen protons and become helium atoms, giving off large amounts of energy until the very, very last hydrogen atom is joined up with the very last hydrogen atom. The sun or the star loses its explosive force, the force that's keeping it from succumbing to its gravitational force. That force goes away, and the star begins to shrink, begins to cool. Of course, it goes through a phase called the red giant, where the corona actually stretches millions and millions of miles, maybe even hundreds of millions of miles out into space, literally consuming any matter in its path from its high temperature. After this, it begins to collapse. And as it collapses, like an ice skater on her skates, spinning, pulling her arms in, she goes faster and faster and faster. Called conservation of momentum. The star does the same thing. Our sun revolves quite slowly. We can see the sunspots pass over the surface of the sun in about a week or 8 days. But as the sun or the star begins to collapse, it begins to spin so fast that it can reach revolutions upwards of 600 to 1,000 revolutions per minute. However, even this is not enough, and as the star continues to collapse, gravitational force becomes so powerful that the electrons that were once revolving nice and free and negatively around the positive protons of helium get sucked down onto the proton, and the negative and the positive come together and form a neutron, a neutral particle. That event is so powerful, it creates a concussion called a supernova. The supernova ejects tremendous amounts of energy and matter into the universe like a magnificent explosion. What's left behind is the dense mass of this star we call a neutron star. It's now a white dwarf. Has no atmosphere. It's not able to put off any heat. And it continues to cool, and it continues to shrink, and it continues to spin faster and faster and faster. But it still cannot overcome its gravitational pull. And as all that weight, all that mass, begins to get packed into a smaller and smaller package, the gravitational pull becomes so intense that light itself cannot escape. And this is what we term a black hole. Now, the black hole that would form an Einstein-Rosen bridge, it wouldn't be 1.4 times the size of our sun. It might be 500 times the size of our sun. It might be 10,000 times the size of our sun. And when you get a mass that large, and it's collapsing, and it's spinning that fast, I want you to picture hitting a tennis ball with a tremendous amount of spin on it and looking at it as it goes over the net to your opponent. Is that tennis ball still round? No, it isn't. It flattens out. And if it could overcome the adhesive structure of that rubber, it would flatten out like a hula hoop. And that's exactly what these massive spinning black holes do. Even though all that matter is on the inside of what we commonly call an event horizon, the point of no return, the point at which nothing can escape if you get inside of it, all that matter that's inside that black hole is slammed up against the inside of that event horizon like a giant cosmic hula hoop with all of its 99% of the matter slammed up in the outside donut shape, and 1% of the matter strewn across the center of it. Now, what kind of diameter are we talking about? We're talking about a diameter about 400 times the diameter of our solar system. That means Pluto's orbit times 400. Now, for us, little Earth, that's a pretty big window. In space, that's a pretty small window. But what does space-time do? What does this fabric we call the universe do when this much gravitational force is spinning at that kind of speed? Well, it forms kind of a gravity tornado, if you could think of it that way. And down the eye of this tornado is a tremendous amount of gravity. Think of it as though you and three of your friends grabbed up a king-sized bedsheet, one at each corner, pulling tightly, but not so tightly as to tear the bedsheet, holding it just as flat as you can, 3 or 4 feet off the floor, and have a fifth friend settle a 16-pound bowling ball in the middle of that bedsheet. Well, try as you might, pulling from the corners, you're not going to get that bowling ball to float above that bedsheet. That bowling ball is going to settle down and create a nice pit for itself in the middle of that bedsheet. This is exactly what gravity does to space-time. Now, picture yourself traveling down one of the threads of that bedsheet. You would think this is a straight line, and you would follow that thread right from one corner to the other, going around the bottom of that bowling ball, and you would never think anything about it. That's what light does in our universe. That's what we do when you get in your car in Dallas and you drive north to Michigan. You are driving as straight as the highways will allow you in a straight line. But in reality, you are following a curve around the Earth. Sure enough, if somebody were to take off from, say, Atlanta, while you took off from Dallas, and you both drove straight north, you would both end up in a traffic accident somewhere around the North Pole, even though both of you are traveling in a perfectly straight line. That's because traveling around the curvature of the Earth, you're actually traveling a curved space-time. It isn't flat or straight at all. And the universe does exactly the same thing. So why is this important? It's important because, well, if you ever saw the movie with Maximilian Schell, where his spaceship falls into the black hole and it's literally just stretched into pieces as it gets close to the black hole. That's accurate if you're talking about a small black hole. But in reality, what would happen with this Einstein-Rosen bridge is that your planet or your ship or your spacesuit, whatever you're in, you'd be traveling toward the middle of this hula hoop. To you, everything would seem normal. You would be traveling along, aging at your normal age. You wouldn't feel any tidal gravity. By the way, tidal gravity is the kind of gravity the moon exerts on the Earth. Sort of squeezes and stretches the oceans. And the oceans follow the moon, even though it's 1/6 the mass of the Earth. The oceans follow the moon around and around and around, creating tides. Somewhere around the equator, the tide is 2 or 3 or 4 feet. Somewhere around Alaska, that tide is about 30, 40, 50 feet. You see the oceans being squeezed at the poles, stretched at the equator. That's tidal gravity. Well, a black hole does the same thing, except when you're traveling through an Einstein-Rosen bridge, as Roy Kerr, the great scientist, would say, there would be no tidal gravity effects on you at all. But what effects would there be? In fact, the universe outside that black hole, outside the eye of that tornado, would age 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times faster than you would. While you travel through the black hole, the universe on the outside might age and pass away before you came out the other side. If you were skillful at it, or someone had been through and back and told you about it, you might be able to negotiate that black hole and travel literally across the universe, across the galaxy, from universe to universe, or even between dimensions. This is what an Einstein-Rosen bridge does. Now you might see how someone could jump in a tin can or a titanium can 400, 500, 1,000 light years away and be here in a few days. This is something that does make sense. And this is something that one day, soon, we will be able to prove. Mathematically, it is completely sound. So we'll take a short break. Small commercial. The Arc of Millions of Years explains why the Mayan calendar ends at the year 2012. Not only that, the detail in the book will help you understand why the Earth is going through such changes now. These tsunamis, earthquakes, hurricanes, sunspots, solar flares occurring well out of the normal pattern of what's predicted. All of these things have been predicted, all of these things have been calculated, and they're explained in the book. Is the Earth really warming? Yes, it is. In fact, all the planets in our solar system are warming. Want to know why? Read the book. Is the Earth from this solar system? No. Want to know the proof? Read the book. Are we alone in the universe? No. Want to know who they are and why they have always been so interested in our planet? Read the book. It's always available at arcofmillionsofyears.com or at your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstores. And now we will move into the final section of our radio program. We have talked a lot about UFOs. We've talked a lot about cosmology. Actually, we have just begun to scratch the surface. Over the next few shows, next few months, maybe a year, we will be able to get through all of this detail. Whether you drive a truck or whether you work in a late-night office as a security guard or whether you're just sitting out on your back porch looking at the stars and listening to the radio tonight, you will know more about these subjects than you ever thought possible by listening to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. And remember, the result is always positive. Section 3 of our broadcast is going to be called The Nephilim. No, it's not a Sesame Street character. The Nephilim were named, for most of us in the Judeo-Christian world, in the Old Testament, Genesis chapter 6. Individuals called the Watchers. They were cast to a lower universe, a lower dimension, by the Creator. Many religions have different names for him, and we'll try to be as fair to everyone as we can and not preach from this radio station. But the fact that the evidence points to his existence, we will not deny. The Nephilim, however, are the enemies of the Creator. They are immortals. They are off-worlders. They have great intelligence. They have great power, but they also have limitations. Sort of like being a mechanical engineer with great experience at building automobiles, plucked out of his manufacturing facility in his quantitative lab, and he's set down in the middle of a third world country with no tools, no calculator, nothing but his brain, nothing but the clothes on his back. But he's intelligent enough to learn the language. He's intelligent enough to impress the people with some basic engineering skills, and lo and behold, they elevate him to the position of elder in their community. Well, not one to live too primitively too much longer. He will begin to teach his people. And he will teach them rudimentary skills at first, maybe bring them out of the Stone Age into the Iron Age, but I doubt seriously in one lifetime or 100 lifetimes he would be able to train those third worlders to mine the first pound of iron ore, turn it into flat steel, and be able to roll it and create an automobile. Even though he's driven one, even though he knows they exist, even though he knows how to assemble one, starting from dirt, it takes a long, long time to develop those skills among the people. And so these off-worlders, these fallen angels, these watchers, they are immortal. They are intelligent. They were cast to this universe, a lower dimension, a lower form of existence. And this is well documented in many, many, many ancient documents. They existed here just after Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden, and they exist on all the planets where mankind can be found. And the Nephilim had an ancient mission, and they did it well. History records that they, even in their limited numbers, worked with the leaders of the earth, worked with their greed, worked with their lust for power, and they began to corrupt the occupants of the earth. Now, they could have just laid waste to the earth, I'm sure, created some super weapon and just killed us all. But that isn't their mission. Because an innocent killed can be saved by the Creator. But a corrupted one, one that has voluntarily turned his life to evil, turned his life to abomination, is much harder to save. May love darkness more than light. This is the mission of the Nephilim. They divided themselves, according to historical records, there were about 200 of them. Some of them had wings, some of them did not. Some of them had very human form. Some of them had animal characteristics about them, full body fur. Extra long arms, more animal-like than human-like. Their DNA was quite a bit different than our DNA in the sense that our DNA, although our genome is becoming more and more well understood, it cannot jump species. We cannot create half anything. Nephilim can, and they did. The Nephilim began to have children with earth women, and they created a race of giants. In fact, many tribes of giants. Lots of evidence that these exist, and we will cover this in great detail in X-Squared Radio forums. You can learn about them in, of course, the Ark of Millions of Years. So, generation after generation, they corrupted the seed of man, and they rendered the institutions with which the Creator tried to organize man and woman utterly meaningless. Destroyed the institution of marriage, made a mockery of what was originally planned to be a glorious legacy of a great Creator. So corrupted did the earth become that in 4800 BC, it was cleansed in a global flood. Of course, the Nephilim, being immortals, being intelligent, but also being limited in their ability to save themselves, not having privy to revelation, had to rely on hard evidence. When were these cataclysms going to occur? How were they going to occur? How was the Creator going to attempt to destroy them? And so they employed men and giants to build edifices, measuring devices, to check the rotation of the earth, to check the position of the earth against stable, immovable points of reference called stars. And so edifices like Stonehenge. And Stonehenge just means stone circle, but the most important one that we sort of revere is the Stonehenge in southern England. And they built the pyramids, elaborate, giant edifices, precisely measuring the position of Orion. Why did they do it? They did it because if the earth got the slightest bit off time, or the slightest bit out of its normal course of motion, it meant cataclysm. Evidently, the Nephilim could not instantaneously move themselves or remove themselves from the planet. It took energy. It took planning. It took careful organization to get themselves off the planet or somehow insulated while on the planet to survive the cataclysm. They had to create records. They had to bury them in impregnable halls of records so that once the cataclysm was over, they could recover them, use the records to rebuild their plan. And so we see the evidence of this that survived the flood. We see the evidence of tremendous energy, countless amounts of human toll to build these great edifices and to revere the fact that we came from the stars, but to do it in a sense that they would worship idols instead of the Creator. Oh yes, we will go into a lot of detail on this, and I promise you, you will learn things you never thought possible. In conclusion, X Squared Radio tonight, we would like to make the bold statement once and for all. We are not alone in the universe. We will just get that on the open right now. Throughout the existence of mankind on this binary planet we call Earth, we have cycled through beliefs about where we came from, why we are here, and where we are going. Various governments, churches, and church governments have gathered up all the science from time to time and burned it all. They have repeatedly plunged mankind back into the Stone Age through various types of warfare. 25,000 years ago, men fought against each other with nuclear weapons. Yes, there is proof of that. 4,000 years ago, wholesale genocide was practiced down to the last animal and blade of grass. 500 years ago, an entire civilization was wiped out through germ warfare using smallpox. The penalty 400 years ago for knowing a Bible verse or two by heart was death by burning, courtesy of the government church. We are nearing a point again in our development as mankind where we're beginning to look up from our banners and our tribal coats of arms in peace. We are rightly beginning to realize that we are earthlings. 90% of the planet's population lives on about 1/30 the planet's landmass. And once again, in our development, we have come to the precipice of global peace and metamorphosis of the race. Once again, we have realized that there is enough and to spare for everyone. Will we survive this time, or will we be led to destruction one more time? The core reason X Squared Radio exists is to help affect the universe, to create enough awareness, enough knowledge, that it will create enough momentum to push us over the edge to change the type of civilization we are. What does that mean? Well, we scientists classify civilizations, not that we've seen any others, but this is how we would classify ourselves, a type zero, basically a hunter-gatherer. We move where the herd moves. We plant whatever the earth will allow us to plant, and we harvest it, and we waste practically everything. Every single square inch of paper we create on this planet ends up in a landfill. Type zero civilization. Always chasing the next meal and the next quarter's profits. a type one civilization, which I believe we are on the verge of becoming. If we will just realize who we are, we will be masters of the energy of one planet. That means we will not waste. That means no one will freeze to death. No one will starve to death. No one will do without the basic needs of life. Of course, a type two doesn't take much logic to figure out. Masters of the energy of an entire solar system. And a type three would be masters of the energy of an entire galaxy. It does seem beyond the stretch of an imagination. It may be 10,000 years, it may be 10 million years from now. But this is our destiny. We have the capability. Our possibility, our potential is absolutely unlimited. And soon, very soon, we will have to realize that our days of charging across the frozen tundra at one another, battle axes in hand, is over. We can be one. And of course, a type four civilization would be one with the universe, creators of universes. So in conclusion, we will take one moment to express our appreciation for you participating in X Squared Radio tonight. We would hope that you have enjoyed the general subject matter of the radio program. I've enjoyed your comments on the live chat. We'll definitely be able to cover more detail as we get further into the year. And maybe we'll expand the radio program to 2 hours and maybe 3 hours. I have explained how we can enter and leave black holes without damage by gravity. Tidal gravity would not affect a body going through a large spinning black hole. Enough mass spreads out the tidal gravity effects. Mathematically, it's quite possible. I'd also like to thank the great thoughts. I have a lot of amateur physicists out there that have sent a lot of good ideas to me, and we'll certainly digest these. And we'll get together again next Wednesday, 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, for X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future, and the result is always positive. I'm Brooks Agnew, your host. Thank you, and till next time, peace, Earth Explorers.
You have been listening to a Blog In Broadcasting service, a service to others' endeavor. Thank you very much, and good night.